Welcome to our discussion segment on the Nuremberg Trials. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. So, John, to say that this was a heavy topic is an understatement.
Yeah, I agree.
It was certainly a dark period in history in terms of the realization of the evil that occurred at the hand of the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And in hearing the podcast and knowing what I know about the trials, I guess my first question is, why were there trials in the first place? And why wasn't there just firing squads?
A couple of reasons. First off, the Allies had just gotten done defeating a country that had summary executions without trials or anything like that, and they wanted to show the world that they were better. Now, ironically, of course, one of the Allied powers represented as sitting in judgment over the Nazis was, of course, the Soviet Union, who had the exact same policies. So the trials' moral kind of foundations were undermined a bit by the Soviet Union's presence. But of course, you had to have the Soviets there. They were the nation who, together with the United States, was most responsible for the end of the war. So to exclude the Soviets wouldn't have really been possible. Another reason was because they wanted the evidentiary process and the discovery process to show the world, these are the crimes that were committed by the Nazis during the 12 years of the Third Reich. They wanted that to be demonstrated before the world. And they also wanted to give the leaders of Nazi Germany who had survived the war a forum basically to incriminate themselves. So when Hermann Göring, for example, or Julius Streicher, or Joachim von Ribbentrop, or these other ardent Nazis who even to the end were loyal followers of Adolf Hitler and his demented ideology, they're on the stands talking about, yes, we did this. Yes, this was our plan. Yes, we were going to destroy democracy in Germany. Yes, we were going to eliminate the Jews of Europe. From their own mouths, they convicted themselves and their regime, and in some ways, the German nation before the world.
So it was about finding fault, obviously.
Oh, yes.
But it was also about allowing the world to see them vocalize their own evil.
Yes.
Okay.
And then it was also about the reality that at least in the American, the British, and the French system of justice, there is a trial. There is a presumption, at least in part, of innocence until you have been proven guilty. Now, that goes away fairly quickly at certain stages of the trial. But then, as now, even if there is overwhelming evidence, or if there appears to be overwhelming evidence, you don't immediately say, well, that person is guilty. Why are we even bothering to have a trial?
Okay. In the podcast, you talked about the cross-examination of Hermann Göring.
Mm-hmm.
And how, in the first instance, he was able to wax on and speak to anything he really wanted to. Because, well, I don't know why, but...
Well, it was because, as I said, Jackson was not a great cross-examiner. He kept asking very open-ended questions.
So what was the turning point then? If he was allowed to continually wax on, at what point was the court like, this has got to stop?
It was on day two, or maybe more than day two. His testimony lasted for several days. But at some point, each of the prosecutors got to ask, from each of the countries, got to ask questions. And David Maxwell Fyfe, the British prosecutor, was far better at asking clear, concise, yes-no questions of Hermann Göring and the other Nazis than Jackson was. Jackson's asking these open questions like, why did you do this? Well, how did this come about? And Göring is going to give an answer, and he was very long-winded because he saw this trial as a way for him to justify himself and his Führer's actions.
Why didn't the court just cut him off?
Because the court was operating under certain rules. And one of the rules is if you ask a witness a question or a defendant a question, you have to let them answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's the same in our system, right? You know, that we have here in the United States now. If you ask a witness or a defendant a question, they have to be able to answer.
Sure.
And so cross-examination, I'm not a lawyer, but I've watched them on TV. No, I've talked to lawyers and I know that they try as best they can in cross-examination to get very clear and concise answers. And David Maxwell Fyfe said in a conversation with Justice Jackson, in their kind of planning out how this was going to be, how this was going to go, Maxwell Fyfe says, honestly, I'm going to treat this man like the Nazi bastard that he is.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. When he first came in, he didn't ask Hermann Göring a single question about, well, what kind of policies did you enact and how did the Nuremberg race laws work? He had a series of documents. First document, he puts on the desk in front of Hermann Göring, and he said, you ordered this atrocity, correct? And Göring's basically forced to either say yes or no. You ordered this. You ordered this. Is this your signature? Is this your signature? Is this your signature? Yes, 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 yes. And then He shows the documents to the judges and says, these are the orders to murder Soviet political commissars, to murder civilians who were helping, involved in the resistance, the order to kill prisoners of war, the orders to confiscate Jewish property, the orders to pay all of the damages from Kristallnacht and the other pogroms, not to the Jewish shopkeepers and synagogue leaders, but to the Reich. All of these crimes. And his signature is right there. And Goering can't interject and be like, but wait, no, this is... No, simple. Simple yes or no. Mm-hmm. Is this yours? Is this yours? And Jackson did a bit of this as he kind of got started in terms of like, okay, I know I need to control this guy a little bit better. But it was Maxwell Fyfe who was really the best prosecutor, certainly among the American and the British. I know less about the French and the Soviet prosecution teams, but of the two, he was the better one at cross-examination. Now, Jackson was great on direct because he can ask very detailed questions and just let the people talk.
Sure. So on that note, as he was shelling out evidence and saying or asking Goering, did you order this? Mm-hmm. And he would say yes and yes and yes. As he's doing this, and in the podcast you talked about footage being shown, obviously, because the Germans apparently recorded everything, which I want to talk about later. Were there other defendants there besides Goering mm-hmm. who were shocked at what they saw?
Yes, there... Accounts differ depending on which biography or autobiography you read, but there is evidence to suggest that probably a quarter to a third of the men in the dock, especially the military men, did not know the extent of the concentration camps, the death camps, the labor camps, things like that. Did not know the extent of the Einsatzgruppen who had been going behind the lines and murdering tens of thousands of Russian Jews. They were unaware of that because their focus was the war.
Right.
So, for example, Karl Dönitz, head of the submarine arm and later the head of the entire German Navy, even though there are speeches made during the war where he references the concentration camps, he maintained to his dying day. I actually earlier today watched a quick interview with him conducted in the 70s towards the end of his life. He said, I had no idea. And he maintained to his dying day, he had no idea the extent of the horrors of the Nazi regime. Now, was he lying? It's certainly possible, but the documents kind of suggest that some of the defendants really didn't know. Goering certainly did. Hess knew,
absolutely.
Kaltenbrunner, a lot of them did.
And when you say he didn't know the extent, that means he has some foreknowledge of what's happening in these concentration camps, right?
He knows that there is forced labor going on because he requisitioned forced labor to build ships. And in the last days of the Third Reich, to help with the evacuation of civilians out of major military bases.
But he didn't, his point was, he said, I didn't know there were furnaces and gas
exactly.
chambers.
Exactly. He disavowed all knowledge of the 6 death camps in Poland.
And I don't ask that to try and say that they weren't guilty, obviously.
Yeah.
It's just more of what was presented was so shocking that obviously there were some defendants there who knew about it
mm-hmm.
and who had signed on it and approved of it, but it was just so shocking that had to be, if you're a regular human being, to see that and not have some reaction to it
mm-hmm.
adversely. I mean, what kind of inhuman could you possibly, would you have to be in order to be like, yep, I can't even say it. Mm-hmm.
But but some of the defendants, that was their mentality, especially Kaltenbrunner, who was who's the senior most surviving SS officer. He was very clear about what he did. Same with Julius Streicher, who was an early anti-Semite and friend of Adolf Hitler, who wrote books, children's books. One of them was called The Gift Pilz, The Poisoned Mushroom. To his dying day, he maintained an absolute loyalty to Adolf Hitler. He would walk the streets of Nuremberg, which was his city, and now he's being tried in that same city, with a whip. And he would just randomly strike anyone who had a nose that was too big, the stereotype being that Jew. Oh, yeah. And to his dying day, his last words were Heil Hitler, which was interesting because then the hangman moved the knot of the rope, the noose used to execute him, from the back of the neck
to the front.
To the side.
To the side.
And he dangled there for like 15, 20 minutes. It didn't snap
his neck. I thought
you were going
to say the front so he couldn't talk anymore. But
no.
No, wow.
he suffocated very slowly, which was a horrible death. But for such a man as Julius Streicher.
I have no problems with that at all.
And one other point to make about the concentration camps, at least one and maybe two of the defendants in the dock at Nuremberg spent time in concentration camps as prisoners. Hjalmar Schacht, former president of the Reich Bank and an early supporter of Hitler, ended up getting caught up in the anti-Nazi conspiracy movement and was imprisoned for a while. So he certainly knew. He spent some time, I believe it was at Dachau. He saw the terror of the Nazi regime from the other side. And I think Neurath was the other one who might have been.
Were those men executed as well?
No, no. Okay. Neurath was he was acquitted, or he was not found guilty on any of the charges. And Schacht got, I believe it was 10 years. No, I got that backward. I'm sorry. Neurath got 15 years for his involvement. He was the Nazi foreign minister early on, so he was involved in a lot of the early plotting to overturn the Treaty of Versailles. Schacht was acquitted on charges, but I believe he was tried in a later West German court.
At the trials, were there any lower-ranking SS officers or collaborators or anything like that? So, as an example, when our forces would go into a camp and open it up and try and save anyone who was left, did they formally execute the guards there? Were they arrested? Like, what happened to all of the perpetrators?
Most of the camps, certainly on the Western Front, were abandoned by the time the Allies got there. I'm trying to think of an instance that I know where camp guards and camp commandants were captured at the sites, and I can't think of one. The Soviets got their hands on a couple of them, and yes, they did institute some summary executions, but most of the SS officers who were involved, the high-ranking SS officers, were tried not in the major Nuremberg trial, the one that's the focus of this podcast, but in a separate one. We talked a few weeks ago about the Krupp trial. That was one of the subsequent Nuremberg trials. There was also one for doctors and for SS camp administrators, and they were charged there. I think the only SS officers who were there at the major trial was Kaltenbrunner, and then I think Zeiss Inquart might have been an SS officer, but his role in the war was more administrative. He was the Gauleiter of Austria at the time. So he was not directly involved. He was involved in deportations, but not in running the camps like Kaltenbrunner was.
The SS officers who abandoned the camps, were they eventually tracked down?
Most of them were, and that's still going on.
Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, every couple of years, there's a new story about a trial in Germany or in Israel where they're finding like 9,500-year-old camp guards.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So it is still going on.
What role did Israel play in tracking down these SS guards and Nazi leadership?
Once Israel was founded, of course, Israel's founded 3 years after the war, or 2 years after the Nuremberg trials end. But the Mossad had a specific agency that was dedicated to Nazi hunting. Their most famous catch was, of course, in, I believe it was 1962, when Adolf Eichmann was captured in Paraguay or Argentina. And he's literally just taken right off the streets and then appears in Israel about, I think it was like a week later or something like that, and is tried publicly for his involvement. He was the organizer of the Wannsee Conference, where the final solution was described. He was head of the RHSA and head of the concentration camp office, or the death camp office, and was, after Himmler and Heydrich, the top two ranking SS officers. He was the one most responsible for
what happened to him in that trial.
He was executed after.
Outstanding.
Afterwards.
I just love hearing that part of it.
Okay.
What happened to the families of some of these men who were responsible?
That's a good question.
Because I'm asking because I've read about suicide parties. That as the Allies advanced, German hierarchy, families, groups would have a party and then at the end drink cyanide. That's how fanatical they were. So,
it did happen.
Yeah. So in thinking about some of these monsters, what happened to their families overall?
So of all the... I don't know a whole lot about the families of most of the defendants at Nuremberg. I know that Frau Göring, Mrs. Göring, she was at Nuremberg and... saw her husband after his sentencing, but before he took his own life in the jailhouse. Again, sources differ. Gustav Gilbert, the American psychologist who talked to a lot of the defendants, also talked to Mrs. Göring, and she revealed the final events of Hitler and Göring's relationship, where Hitler ordered Göring's execution. Because in the last days, as Hitler is in the bunker and Berlin is collapsing all around him, Göring sends him a message saying, if I don't hear from you in 24 hours, I'm going to assume with Berlin surrounded that you have fallen, and I'm going to take over the leadership of the Reich. And Hitler was so far gone by this point that he orders Göring's death, and he orders the death of Mrs. Göring and of their daughter. And so, obviously they escaped. They were able to get out of Berchtesgaden in the far south of Germany, surrendered to the Allies, and survived. And his daughter might still be alive. I don't remember. if she's not, she died fairly recent. Actually, you know what? So I'm giving accurate information. Let me look that up. I'm sorry. She died in 2018. Etta Goering was Hermann Goering's daughter. She died in 2018, so fairly recently. And there are still several sons and certainly grandsons and mm-hmm. daughters yeah. and granddaughters of a lot of these guys who are still around. Albert Speer's family is still around and still involved in World War II commemoration and things like that. I believe so is Rudolf Hess's. Mm. And some of them are actually still involved in involved in neo-Nazi circles. Heinrich Himmler's either daughter or granddaughter still goes around. She obviously can't go into Germany and say these things, but she's involved in neo-Nazi circles still to this day, talking about how her ancestors.
That's unbelievable.
Was. Yeah. Well, evil is very seductive, as we have talked about many times in this podcast.
So when we think about German culture at the time, obviously there was a lot of Nazi propaganda going on and a lot of teaching specifically. Can you elaborate on the education studies that were conducted after the war? And then knowing that there was all of this corruption in the educational system, how did the Allies combat that?
Mm-hmm. The education system in Germany by 1934, so Hitler comes to power January 30th, 1933. Within a year, he, using his education ministers and various Nazi officials, he is able to, in the words of one German bureaucrat whose name I don't remember, he has, quote, liquidated the German school as an institute of intellectual pursuit. He has turned Germany's schools into nothing more than propaganda, where truth, where facts have no relevance, they don't even make it through the front door, where children from the age of 5 to the age of 16 are drilled every single day in Nazi ideology. The same is true of the Hitler Youth. Same is true of the BDM, the League of German Girls. That's where a lot of the young people who go to war in 1939, you know, they've got 5-6 years of Nazi education drilled into them. They're blind to the immorality of what it is that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't explain the people who are already adults, who are already out of school. But it's interesting. The studies that were done after the war, the first one was Gustav Gilbert, who was actually interviewing the defendants at Nuremberg, gave them an IQ test. And discovered, as I said in the podcast, that there really wasn't a correlation between how smart you were or how high you scored on the IQ test and how rabid a Nazi you were. But that led to other people saying, let's look into this. And so sociologists and educational experts and statisticians flooded into Germany, into the western part specifically, because the east was closed off because of the Cold War, and started interviewing people. And they discovered that the more time you had spent in education, the more likely you were to be a fanatical devotee of Nazism.
Wow.
So people with postgraduate degrees were more likely to be a Nazi than people with just a bachelor's degree. Bachelor's degree more than an associate's, or the German equivalents, basically, is what I'm using here. To high school, to middle school, yeah. There weren't really peasants in Germany at that point, but there were German farmers who had no use for higher education or anything like that. They were the least likely to be Nazis. They simply wanted to be left alone. I don't want to get involved in any of this stuff. I'll sell my crops and just leave me alone. Whereas the people who had spent years and years, you know, having all kinds of ideas drilled into their head, not Nazi ideas, but just various high and intellectual topics that they were studying for years and years and years on end, kind of, in the opinion of the people who wrote these studies, kind of separated them from real world concerns. To where they were all about different theories. And they thought, okay, well, these theories, these whether it's economic theories or engineering theories or social history theories or whatever they are, we just need to find the right theoretician to put them into practice. And a lot of them saw Adolf Hitler as a vehicle to put their ideas into practice.
Wow.
Because not every Nazi idea came from Mein Kampf. There was plenty of other stuff that was kind of added in as the Nazis gradually took power during what was known as the Gleichschaltung, the coordination of the Reich in turning it into a Nazi state.
Hmm.
Those are the education studies. Now, as far as kind of deprogramming Germany,
right,
that's a multifaceted program. John McCloy, running the Allied Control Council, he is involved in denazification, he and others. He wasn't the only one. But they physically removed all the images of Hitler and of, you know, Nazi symbols and things like that. The swastikas are all taken down and made illegal. Mein Kampf is banned in Germany. I believe it still is, unless you're involved in like research and things like that. Then you can get special dispensation. That may have changed recently, but for a long time, that was the only way you could get a copy of that book. And then the Allies basically took over the education system.
Hmm.
And they started to teach the new generation of Germans the real history of the Third Reich, not the perverse racial history that was taught under the Third Reich. And it's interesting that there is only one law in Germany, as far as I know, certainly only one major law in Germany that began under the Third Reich and which continues to this day, and that's their ban on homeschooling. I have a very positive vision of homeschooling, view of homeschooling. I work with homeschoolers a lot. I love homeschooling. But in Germany, under the Nazis, it was, we want everyone getting Nazi ideology. Right. And right. After the war, that law was kept because we don't want Nazi parents countering the Allied denazification effort in the German schools. Hmm. So every child has to be in either a public or a private school. No homeschooling in Germany. And then there were, the trials were a huge part of this. I mean, the German people see what their leaders had done in many areas around the concentration camps, as we talked about, I think, a couple of weeks ago in Band of Brothers. It shows a town near a labor camp where people actually had to go in and clean up. General Patton, in the areas of Germany under his military command, he had people like picking up bodies and cleaning out crematoria and things like that, because he wanted everyone who lived near these areas who could see and smell what was going on. This is going to be burned into your mind for all time. Mm-hmm. So that's a brief summary of denazification. Again, we could do a whole couple episodes on all of that.
Absolutely. So earlier you were talking about how the Soviets had to be part of this trial.
Yes.
The Soviets were responsible for many atrocities.
Yes.
Both before and after the war and during the war.
Mm-hmm.
So the only reason why, in my mind, they were allowed to be part of the trial on the prosecution side is because they were part of the Allies.
Because they won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have won if not for Allied support, right? I mean,
Probably.
It's so tough to
say.
It's a what-if, but I'm just
saying. You and your what-if questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's my shoe? I'm going to throw it at you, I swear.
Specifically, the 20,000 Polish officers who were slaughtered.
Mm-hmm. At Kachin, yeah.
Yeah, and the Soviets tried to pin that on the Nazis. Were they successful in doing that?
They were not.
Okay.
The Allies brought in, or not the Allies, I'm sorry, the German defense team brought in eyewitnesses who lived in and around the village of Kachin where the massacre took place, and they identified, and there were so many of them who identified the murderers as Soviets. It was established pretty clearly. And then when the bodies were discovered, I believe it was in the 1970s when the mass graves were uncovered, and it was found that it was Russian ammunition and Russian weaponry that was involved.
Were the communists ever penalized for that?
I don't think so, no.
Wow.
Because, you got to consider who's running the Soviet Union at that point. Joseph Stalin, he murdered 7 million people in the Holodomor, another 3 million in his
purges. His total was 37
purges.
Total?
His total is somewhere between 30 and 50 million dead. 15,000, 20,000 Poles, that was nothing to him.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I remember reading an account, and this was not Churchill's finest hour at all, where he turned over prisoners of war to the Soviets, and they were slaughtered.
Yeah.
They were just gunned down.
It did happen. Way too often. Of the 250,000 soldiers who were captured at Stalingrad, the great turning point battle in the Eastern Front, 250,000 surrendered, I believe it was, and about 6,000 made it home. The rest died in Soviet captivity or in the gulags.
This is a whole other podcast, but just trying to understand why those atrocities are not highlighted in the same way as Germany's atrocities.
Stay tuned for season 5. I think that should definitely be a discussion.
I agree.
Because that is a huge topic.
It's time we had that talk.
I agree.
So you talked about the evidence being presented. My first question is, why was there so much of it? You would think with these types of crimes, there would be an attempt to burn records. Because when I think about the fall of France, the French tried to burn everything that they could in Paris. Yeah. Open courtyards full of bonfires before the Nazis arrived. And that's what I would think the Nazis would try to do. Did they do
that?
They
did. Okay. There are a number of documents that are referenced in the Nuremberg Files that they never turned up. But there's something unique in the German character, and it's not exclusive to the Nazis, where they documented all kinds of stuff. William Shirer, in his masterpiece, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, comments on this, and he says, never before has there been such a treasure trove of documentation that so clearly lays out the program of evil that was the Third Reich. And the collapse of Germany was so sudden. After the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944 to January 1945, there was nothing left in Western Germany to stop the Allies. And so they rolled into German cities one at a time very, very quickly. And they captured all kinds of archives. And there simply wasn't time to burn these documents. And you've also got to consider the Germans were more interested in surrendering themselves to the Allies than in fighting them, because who's coming on the other side of Germany?
The Soviets.
The Russians. And they're not going to be nearly as kind to captured Germans as the Americans and the British and the French were.
It still begs the question why they recorded it. Was it because they didn't believe it was evil?
Like, no.
What they were doing
was... Oh, that's self-evident. No, they didn't believe it was evil. And they wanted it to be known.
No part of this struck them as wrong, as absolutely terribly evil. So just trying to understand the mindset. I know I can't because I'm not crazy.
No, we can't.
But I mean, just how is that possible?
You have to distinguish between the true believers and what I'll call the everyday actors, the everyday people who are involved. The true believers in Nazism, the men at the top, the people who ran the concentration camps, who signed the death orders, Hitler, of course, being the worst, and then people like Heydrich, Freisler, Himmler, Goebbels, Goering, all of those. No, they did not believe. Their consciences had been so just silenced, I believe. I obviously can't read their minds or anything like that, but based on what they did and on the surviving records, no, there was nothing in their hearts or in their minds that said, this is wrong. Then you have the everyday actors, the people who used the defense at Nuremberg. I was just following orders. And in that category,
I want to chat through that later on for sure.
And in that category, you have a lot of the Nuremberg defendants and the thousands and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions of soldiers in the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS who may have felt deep down that this was wrong, but either they quieted it because the Führer is always right. That's the Führer principle, the Führer principle, the leadership principle that says in Germany, whatever the Führer says goes, or they feared what would happen if they didn't. They feared for themselves and for their families, and so they did it, even if they knew it was wrong. And this is not unique to Germany. I don't want to be singling out the Germans. I mean, throughout history, atrocities, as we've talked many times about the book Good Men and other accounts of otherwise kind, decent, good-hearted people doing terrible things.
And it not happening all at once. It happening as a slow burn, the slow progress of them being ordered to do things that are inappropriate or unlawful. Mm-hmm. And slowly but surely, either because they're afraid that they're going to lose their jobs or they're going to be put in jail or something more terrible happening to them or their families.
Or because they're true believers in the ideology.
Right. Well, I'm talking specifically about people who at the beginning are literally just doing their jobs.
Okay.
But they continually compromise and compromise and compromise until finally they're as bad as the very people who are ordering these terrible things. You know, in history, and feel free to correct me, but it seems like very rarely is it someone starting on the extreme. Mm-hmm. There obviously are those, you know, Hitler is one, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
Even Hitler didn't start out as a monster. He was made, and he made himself into a monster in his early life.
But in thinking about, like, you talked about the book Good Men. Mm-hmm. So, example there, Polish officers who were regular police officers who, when the Nazis invaded, they were asked to start doing things that they would see as wrong, or that they saw as wrong, but they didn't want to get in trouble, and they didn't want to get put in jail, and they continually did more and more things that were inherently, morally, terribly wrong until they themselves became monsters.
Right.
So that's who I'm trying to kind of talk through, is that type of person who believes, I'm just following orders. And I want to talk through that more here in a second. In talking about the evidence, can you give our audience some examples of the evidence that was presented at the trial?
So a lot of it was, as I said, documents that bore the signatures of Nazi leaders that proved or that referenced crimes. So you had a huge treasure trove of documents. It's something like 6-7 million individual papers that have since been compiled and published, and you can now read them. If you are interested in all of this, it's a lot, and if you don't get a good translation, it can be kind of confusing. So there was that. Then there were eyewitness accounts. There were affidavits submitted by people on all sides of the war who were not present or who could not be present. The Allied commanders all submitted these documents and these testimonies. And then you had, of course, the video footage, which we've already referenced, actual footage taken in the days and weeks after a concentration camp or one of the death camps was liberated. You get footage from Auschwitz, from Buchenwald, from Dachau, from camps all across Germany, British soldiers, French soldiers, American soldiers, Russian soldiers, other Allied soldiers taking this footage, documenting it, showing it to the world. And then lastly, you have the eyewitness testimony for both the prosecution and the defense. So you get, for example, a French woman. I forget her name, but she was the first eyewitness who testified at Nuremberg. She was a member of the French Communist Party. And she describes being taken to Auschwitz on a train. And we get the first eyewitness account of cattle cars and things like that. And on that train, there were about 200 people, and she's asked how many of them ever returned to France, and she said something like 23 or horrifying number. The rest died there. Stories or eyewitness testimony of Jews who assisted the doctors in performing all these medical experiments. There was a young man who was, I believe he was Polish, and he was involved in one of the medical experiments at Dachau, where prisoners would be plunged into freezing cold water and then warmed in various ways because the Nazis were trying to figure out how do we keep our airmen who ditch their planes into the North Sea and it's freezing cold. How do we keep them alive when they get hypothermia and are rescued by U-boats or things like that? So he's testing all of these various methods. And he talks about how most of these people went into convulsions, they seized, and then they died. And he's watching all of this. And this Nazi doctor is just, taking notes on his clipboard about all of this. And then you have witnesses for the defense. The most famous of those, of course, is Rudolf Höss, the commander of Auschwitz, who casually tells the entire court, about 2.5 million people were killed while I was in the commandant of Auschwitz. I suggested the use of Zyklon B. I suggested building the crematoria. I increased efficiency and all of this, describing, as he said, it's no different than a rat catcher catching rats. So the eyewitness testimony, I think, was the most eye-opening for everyone at the court. An American reporter at Nuremberg and was broadcasting back to the United States just describes in his various broadcasts, he said, I'm speechless.
That's why I haven't said anything.
Yeah.
And
the scary thing is, these people are sitting in the dock, and 20, 30 feet away are the men responsible for all of this. And they're confronting their tormentors for the first time.
How do you not just pull a sidearm and
unload
it?
Yeah, but there were soldiers right behind.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. Let's talk about the concept of just following orders, because that seemed to be a pretty prominent theme at the trials.
It was the prominent theme for most of the defendants, yeah.
How is that handled, that excuse, that false cop-out excuse, at the beginning, and then how was it handled at the end? How did the response to it change over the course of the trial?
It really didn't.
Okay.
It was never considered a justified defense, except in very, very specific cases. I would argue that war is inherently immoral because it involves the destruction of life, and life is sacred. All lives are sacred. Sometimes it's necessary. It's absolutely necessary. I'm not a pacifist who's like, no, we can never go to war or anything like that. So as a result, sometimes if you are ordered to invade a country, even if at the highest level, the justifications, the reasoning is complete garbage, like the invasion of Poland, for example, it is not necessarily, and this is my opinion, it's not necessarily justified to blame the generals on the field who are carrying out those orders. However, there is a distinction between soldiers on the battlefield who either have volunteered or who have been conscripted, and yes, sometimes that does happen, certainly happened on all sides in the war, taking action against them versus taking action against captured soldiers, like in the Commissar Order. Or against civilians, like in the Night and Fog Decree, or against civilians in your own country. In those instances, I believe, and the Nuremberg judges believed, just following orders is never a justification for that. It's one thing to go after people in a war situation. You brought it on yourself, or you started a war against another country. That's different, going after soldiers on the battlefield, than groups that are not equally armed. So it's a power dynamic there. That was the position of the Nuremberg justices from beginning to end.
Okay.
It's why those generals who are involved at the highest levels of the war, Keitel and Jodl, are both executed. Now, there's been a lot of evidence that has come to light since to suggest that one of those two, General Alfred Jodl, probably should not have been executed. He was probably not innocent, but he probably had the same level of culpability as, for example, the two Grand Admirals, both of whom were given life sentences instead of the death penalty. And his wife actually petitioned to have his judgment reversed. It was reversed in the early 50s, and then I think it was reversed again. It's been, his status has continued to fluctuate over the years because there's always that question of, all right, just following orders, how far can that go legally and morally? Keitel? No. He was a toady of the Führer. Actually, was he a monster? Yes. But I think more than that, he was so enthralled by the majesty of Hitler's victories early in the war that he believed that he was a god. I'll do whatever you say. Oh yeah,
really?
Not a religious god, but a military, a warlord beyond anything anyone had seen. And when you look at it, before June 1941, Germany had never lost a war, with the exception of the air war against Great Britain. Germany's armies on the battlefield were undefeated. So a military man who went through the First World War, witnessed the defeat, now seeing the collapse of France, the humiliation of Great Britain.
But was that the result of Hitler or the German generals on the field?
It was the Fuhrer, because remember, all of the blame was placed on Hitler at Nuremberg.
Gotcha.
But all of the glory during the war was accrued, even by the generals. They said this was us following the Fuhrer's directives.
Okay.
Yeah.
So out of curiosity, even Rommel said that?
Early on, yeah.
Okay.
Until the bad decisions started to come out of the Fuhrer's headquarters. And then he realized, okay, this man is not the military genius we all thought. He is a deranged
lunatic. Yeah, because a lot of the German generals came from a hierarchy and class mm-hmm. that Adolf Hitler was not part of.
True.
And so I was under the impression—
Bohemian corporal, yeah. As Churchill always called him.
Yeah, I was under the impression that these generals kind of looked down on him for a long time.
Oh, until the war they did. None of his generals had any confidence in him. That's why in 1938, as he's pushing for the invasion of Czechoslovakia, that's the closest that the resistance movement came to acting against him and removing him that they would until the bomb plot of 1944. They almost were just like, all right, we're done with this guy. But he ultimately succeeded. Well, he didn't succeed. Chamberlain gave him what he wanted. Chamberlain saved him from a coup. And that's when the attitude started to change. And then a year later, when Germany blitzed across Poland and conquered it in 3 weeks, and then when they knocked out France in 6 weeks, people are saying, okay, you know what? Maybe there's something to this Bohemian corporal.
Wow. What was the lasting legacy of the trials, both in when we look back on it in history and its effect on world courts and mm-hmm. so on?
It was the motivation for creating the International Criminal Court and various other international law enforcement agencies. It was decided at Nuremberg to codify genocide as a crime beyond the jurisdiction of a single nation, that only a court of common humanity could really punish.
Has there been
that
a similar court, though, that's convened since then?
Well, the International Criminal Court that sits in The Hague, they style themselves as the legal successors to Nuremberg. Now, that court has not always been the most unbiased body. Yeah, they managed to condemn, you know, certain instances of genocide, and yet they're strangely silent in other instances of genocide, like, for example, what's going on in China right now.
That's so interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. That's really the biggest legacy, is the definition of genocide. That's the legacy of the Nuremberg trials. Another one is, of course, the controversy of, is this victor's justice versus was there actual justice that was done at Nuremberg? A lot of American legal scholars, including some of Jackson's colleagues on the Supreme Court, were like, this is a show trial. There's no justice being done.
Well, what did they want happening? I mean, what were the options here?
A lot of people thought that since the Nazi Party came to power legally, the German people who put them into office should be the ones to try them, rather than having the victors.
So it wasn't like, hey, we can't do anything here. It was like, there needs to be another type of process.
No, there needs to be a process that is legitimate in the eyes, not just of the world, but in the eyes of the German people, specifically.
Well, John, I'm going to be honest. I don't know how to end our conversation here, because this is such a dark period, or the end of a dark period in history. Having seen a lot of the footage from those trials and read a lot about this time period, you obviously know a lot more. This has been your thing that you've taught on and that you continue to teach on. I'm at a loss for words. I know that these trials were intended to provide some justice for the crimes committed, but I can't think of a temporal justice that would be enough.
There isn't one.
For the evil that was there. And so honestly, I don't know how to end our conversation.
Yeah. I end this section in my world history textbook. We close, the end of the World War II section deals with Nuremberg and then leads us into the Cold War and sets up American history with, I don't have the book in front of me, but basically with the understanding that ultimately justice was served to all of the Nazis, either in this world or in the next, because you and I believe, and I think most people in the world believe, that this world is not the end, that our actions, what we do, to quote a famous movie, what we do in life echoes in eternity. And regardless of your religious beliefs, the men and women of the Third Reich who did all of this, they did face justice. Some of them faced justice during the war. Some died by their own hands. others were prosecuted and executed or imprisoned and all of that. But when their lives ended and when they met their maker, their final fate was the eternal justice. You said there's no temporal justice. That's true. But there is an eternal judge.
Right.
That they faced. And just to kind of finish up, Joe and I went to Auschwitz in 2010.
Yeah, we did.
And it was an experience. It's not something that you would ever want to go see, but it is necessary. And I hope that as travel becomes a thing again, anyone listening to my voice who is interested in this period, who finds themselves with the opportunity to go on a European tour and go to Auschwitz, you will be mad at me for recommending it, but you will be glad that you went because it gives perspective on the horrors of Nazi Germany all in one place, because it's not just a museum of what happened there. It's a museum of the Third Reich in one place. But that night, as we were talking about everything, and then I think, Joe, you went back to your room fairly early and kind of wrote out some just your thoughts trying to process it. Is that correct? Why don't you tell us where these thoughts came from, and then I'm going to read a little bit of what you wrote that night.
Yeah, that was a day. That was a day of days. We went and saw the camp. And when we got back to the hotel, I remember not really being able to talk about very much. And the students were the same way. All of us came back from that experience and we all just kind of went to our rooms. And sometimes the best thing that you can do in those circumstances is just not say anything, but write it out. And that's what I did. And it did help, but I don't have the words to describe what I saw.
Why don't you read instead of me? Why don't you read what you wrote? We'll let this be our final note on World War II for this season.
At Birkenau, there's a memorial between crematoriums 2 and 3. It consists of bricks, each representing a person killed in the camp, layered many times atop one another. I spoke with our guide and asked if the bricks were the same shape when the memorial was built. She said that they were. Now, after years of rain and snow, each one is as unique as the person they represent. Each one is not the same. Each one is different. I felt the tears in my eyes as I remembered each voice was unique, not the same. They were not numbers, but names, not the same. Each pair of shoes tied for the first time, not the same. Each pot, doll, shirt, and strand of hair belonged to someone who was not the same. God made each name different. The letters found in the mud of Auschwitz all asked the same thing. Will you remember me? Will you remember me as I was? I will, and John will, and our students on that trip certainly will. And that experience is something that we will always remember.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of the Nuremberg Trials. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.